This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian
Kilmeade. Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Historic day, a lot going on. And, of course, we'll take your phone calls when we can. Mitch Albom's going to be joining us today. He's one of the most successful authors in the country and around the world. He has got a book out called Twice. Cold Twice is his latest book. And, of course, we know Tuesdays with Maury is what really put him on the map. But he's always been a great sports guy, columnist with the Detroit Free Press, former guy in the sports reporters. I watch them every Sunday. Also, a quick note, Patriot Awards coming up faster than you think, November 6th, 8 o'clock. Go to foxnation.com/Patriot Awards and get your tickets. They're flying off the shelves. And we know about the big news, so let's get to the big three.
Number three.
So you don't
think... I feel like this is unnecessarily argumentative. What is your question?
Well, to those voters. Okay, so you...
I don't want to keep doing this. I'm going to call it. Thank you.
You're not going to do the interview with us?
Nope, not like this. I'm not. Not with seven follow-ups to every single question you ask.
She is just an embarrassment. Katie Porter leading the fray in the early polling when it comes to the next governor's race in California. This brings me to this question. The Democratic political politics of incompetence. From the California governor frontrunner to the New Jersey governor race, we see Dems in the lead, but their flaws are jaw-dropping. America, you deserve better. Will you vote beyond your party?
Number two.
How will you decide which workers get back pay and which workers do not?
Well, we're going to see. Most of them are going to get back pay, and we're going to try and make sure of that. But some of them are being hurt very badly by the Democrats, and they therefore won't qualify.
Shutdown in day nine. Intentions are exploding on both sides. Will anything break the deadlock?
Number one.
The 20-point plan developed by Steve Witkoff with Jared Kushner is one of the most elegant pieces of diplomacy we can remember in recent years.
That is Ambassador Michael Oren. On the precipice of peace, President Trump is preparing to fly to Egypt to sign a deal to bring the fighting to an end in Gaza and begin the rebuilding process in the region. We have the historic details coming your way, and there's a lot. We know this. The process has begun. We just watched an Israeli press conference by their spokesperson, and they say for the next 24 hours, in Gaza, the IDF is going to pull back. And then after they pull back, they'll have a 72-hour window to return all 48 hostages, including 20 we believe to be alive, 28 confirmed dead, two Americans among those confirmed dead, Itai Chen and Omar Nutra of Plainview, New York, are among them. Let's expect to get the bodies back. The Qatari foreign minister has confirmed what the Turkish representatives have said, as well as the Hamas spokespeople have said, and now you have the Israelis also present, all agreeing that an agreement has been reached. So these hostages are going to be out very soon. And I can't believe it, but you have chance, according to reports, in Gaza for Donald Trump and chance in Tel Aviv for Donald Trump. For Trump, he posted this. I'm proud to announce that Israel and Hamas have both signed off on the first phase of our peace plan. This means all the hostages will be released very soon. Israel will withdraw their troops to an agreed upon line. It's called the Yellow Line. And there'll be a strong, durable peace. That's everybody's hope. Now, look what they get in exchange. And this is tough. They exchanged 1,950 prisoners. 250 have death sentences, which means they've killed innocent Israelis in their past. Now, they're going to be released. They're going to be put on buses and going to be treated like heroes. Now, in many cases, they're going to go back to terror, and that's the worry. But what are the choices? The Saudi television station Al Arabiya in their Cairo bureau says this. Hamas has already started moving the hostages to secure locations in preparations for them being handed over in the coming days. Here's my fear. They lost track of some of them. That's what I heard initially when they took 250 or 260, that so many different groups grabbed them. They never expected to get this many hostages and that they were all in desperate situations. But I hope that Turkey, who has so much control in that region, and Qatar said, no joke, get all of them back. And even Islamic Jihad, the second strongest group in that area, said what was achieved in the ceasefire and prisoner exchange is not a gift from anyone. You do not deny the Arab and international efforts. The statement emphasizes the tremendous sacrifices made by the Palestinian people, but rejects that they lost or they gave in. But it didn't say we reject the deal and we're not recognizing it. Here's Ambassador Huckabee, cut five.
Well, let's give credit where credit is due. There were a lot of people at the embassy that did a lot of just groundwork. But the real key is President Trump. He's the one that made this happen. Certainly, envoys Witkoff and Jared Kushner were a very big part of sealing the deal, bringing it together. But this would never have happened without the leadership of President Trump. He brought people together that no one thought would ever sit together, talk, and come to an agreement. And it's really a remarkable day. And I'll tell you, there is a great sigh of relief being heaved throughout Israel today, because this is a day that everyone here has been praying to happen for two solid years.
So in the first phase, I think it's going to be the most impactful. But the second phase of setting up a peace council that will have people like Tony Blair on it, and the president will head it. But people on the ground, I hope it's the Arab League is there. Because we remember Iraq. When you put an American in charge, Paul Bremer, they could be a saint. It doesn't matter. They don't want to, in the Arab country, in an Arab region, they don't want to see an American there. They don't want to see a Westerner there. Dave Ignatius, as plugged in as anybody in the region, said this morning, cut nine.
The next phase is going to be difficult because Hamas essentially has to agree to surrender, has to agree to give up its weapons. Hamas fighters who give their weapons will get amnesty, allowing a kind of calm to return to Gaza. But the final terms, where Israel will withdraw to, exactly who will run Gaza, whether Hamas can be held to President Trump's demand that they play no role whatsoever in the future governance of Gaza is still remains to be seen.
So if they give up all the hostages, what keeps him alive? One thing about Israel, there's a lot about Israel, but they'll hunt you down. This 1972 massacre at the Olympics, they hunted everybody down. When they had all the explosions and the attacks, including killing U.S. Marines, they hunted every one of those terrorists down. In fact, they killed one about 2 years ago. They never stop. So with these Hamas leaders, whatever's left of that leadership, you put down your weapons. The word is they're concerned about being hunted down. They have every reason to be concerned. They started this. They did the massacre. And we was talking to a hostage, former hostage who spent hundreds of days in captivity. And he says that Hamas totally was surprised by Israel's relentless pounding of Gaza. They thought this thing would be over in a couple of weeks. They never thought they would actually go into Gaza. Man, they almost took all of it. Fareed Zakaria on CNN, cut 22.
Hamas seems to have agreed to release all the hostages in the first phase. They had never been willing to do that before. And that is a game changer because Hamas loses all its leverage once the hostages are released. That is the only leverage they have.
So what guarantees do they have of Israel following through? That makes sense. Now they say Hamas reaches out to Trump and says through emissaries, we're counting on you to make Israel live up to his obligations. What's in that agreement? We know the framework is 20 points. And the framework is pretty detailed because it takes in a lot of different perspectives, but very understandable. It's not written in lawyer ease. But the details are going to be important. So Hamas says, yeah, if we, what they call it, if they decommission their weapons and where they put their rockets, they say, in storage in Egypt, what happens to them? They have a huge problem with giving up their weapons. That was one of the stumbling blocks. And through all of this, we're still in a government shutdown. And the president's probably going to be leaving the country to go to Egypt. So if you want him to take the lead, don't expect him to take the lead. He's going to be busy. Brett McGurk, who was working for Trump for a while, went over and led negotiations over in the region with Biden. Cut 18.
That's my understanding. This really is the end of the war. All hostages are being released. Israeli forces are still in the Gaza Strip, and there's now a consensus that Hamas's days in Gaza are over.
That's the hope. All right? That's the hope. We're going to take a time out and come back a little bit about and talk about the shutdown, and then we'll talk to Mitch Albom about his new book and so much more in the region and the big picture. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course, or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Without the use of force, this 20 points would not have been possible. And the use of force, not just against Hamas, but also against Iran. The President Trump was willing to step up and project American power. What's missing, I think, from the conversation this morning is the restoration, the revival of the Pax Americana after years of withdrawal and isolationism in the Middle East. And that, I think, is truly maybe the most historic consequence of these 20 points of this agreement. Now, having said all that, you know, this is maybe the end of the beginning. Hamas still has its guns. Hamas is still embedded in Gaza. Houthis are still firing. Iran is now rebuilding. The war may be far from over, but the fact is that these hostages are returning, and that was Israel's major war aim. It is an extraordinary achievement.
By the way, yeah, so Iran is trying to rebuild their nuclear program, but everyone's keeping an eye on it. And I don't think Israel will hesitate if they start making progress to hit them again and hit them again hard. I just don't. I mean, they already figured out so much more. And Iran's trying to figure out why they were so vulnerable. The Houthis haven't stopped. And what changes if somehow Hamas starts sending rockets into Israel? Maybe there's not going to be the great numbers, but what changes? Also, the rest of the tunnels have to be destroyed. They've only taken out 50% of the tunnel complexes. They all got to be destroyed. Not one can be around. Not one can be allowed to sustain itself. And a lot of, especially the tunnels that lead right into Egypt, that's got to stop because that's also a weapons bridge, and that's not effective. So yesterday, we had day eight. That was day eight of the lockdown. Today is day nine of the lockdown, and tensions are really getting high. Chuck Schumer, this tone-deaf guy that should be the most experienced politician in Washington, came out and said, every day that goes by is better for us. Really? That means people missing paychecks, and that's better for you. The military not getting paid, that's better for you. People being furloughed or fired, that's better for you. Why is that better for you? The country's losing $15 billion a week, that's better for you? Absolutely insane. Also, I'm wondering what happens. The president's going to be going out of the country. He's going to be doing something historic in Egypt. He's going to be going to address the Knesset in Israel. Those are the plans. Well, who's going to lead the lockdown talks? Will somebody shut down talks? Will somebody actually step up? Well, I'll tell you who stepped up yesterday, Mike Lawler. He stepped up and stepped on Hakeem Jeffries. He went ahead and told him, we could just carry on. Obamacare, why don't you just sign this piece of paper? Listen to this exchange between these two. Let's start at cut 35.
Why don't we sign on right now?
Did your boss, Donald Trump?
You can
Trump?
Easily extend the ACA right now.
Did your
right
boss,
now.
Donald Trump,
he's
give
not
you
my boss.
Yes, he is.
No, he's not. And by the way,
so let me ask you a
why
question.
Did you vote to
let
shut the government
question.
Down? No, it's sad.
Relevant.
It's sad. You could easily sign on to
you're
this.
You're embarrassing yourself
you could
right
sign
now.
On to this. The only embarrassment here is
you're not going to talk to me and talk
and
over me.
New York residents
because you don't want to hear what I have to say.
Oh, I'm listening.
So why don't you just keep your mouth shut?
Well, Hakeem Jeffries, not with the best comeback in the world. They're going at it. Let's listen to more. Cut 36.
I voted for a clean CR to keep the government open and funded. You voted to shut it
you're
down.
You're embarrassing yourself right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, leader, with all due respect,
well, say,
you're the one.
Why are you playing yourself?
You're the one who
you
actually voted to shut actions? The government down.
Actually, you
it's
know
sad.
That's not true.
It's sad. You voted to shut the government
listen,
down.
Do Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the President?
Right, and you're smart enough to know that you need 60 votes in the Senate, right?
Is that right? No.
Do you need 60 votes in the Senate
was
or no?
Were 60 votes needed to pass your one big ugly bill?
Reconciliation, which you did with the IRA. Boy, that really... reduced inflation.
Are you,
you
trying
did a great
to elevate yourself because you're afraid you're about to lose re-election?
No, I'm not going to lose re-election. You spent $42 million last cycle.
Mike,
you didn't
Mike,
do that
let
great.
Me say, I've great. Indulged you. I've given you your 15
you
minutes
haven't,
of
You
fame.
Haven't answered any of the questions.
You're a complete and total embarrassment.
Yeah.
You're embarrassing yourself and your district right now, and you're going down to defeat next year.
He's not. He never does. He had Jamal Bowman. He unseated him and then beat him back again twice. And despite $42 million, he is one of the most talented guys and the most confident guys in the House. But that's how bad things are getting. And then we had the speaker run into a senator, Senator Aguiar of Arizona. And they went at it, too, together, because they're both speaking at each other, not to each other. And I could just play back and forth with Thune and Hakeem Jeffries and Schumer. And Johnson keeps saying it's the same thing. I get it. A clean CR, negotiate on the other elements, but don't shut the government down. They keep it shut down. And guess who's paying the price? I tell you what, air travel is really bothering me. You know, it's not so cold. The air travel is not for the elite. It's for the everyman. And now you have air traffic controllers already strung out and overworked because Pete Buttigieg, as a terrible transportation secretary, ran it into the ground over antiquated equipment while with his bike helmet on, pretended to bike to work every day. But did he do any work? Now air traffic controllers, dramatically undermanned, are choosing not to show up, causing massive delays around the country. Now, they say that they don't get paid enough and they're overworked and underappreciated. Well, join the club. A lot of people feel that way. I don't feel that way, but a lot of people do. They still show up for work. Why they're using that right now, I don't really get. I'm wondering if there's a sense now that with the peace deal, so supported by Hamas, they're chanting Trump's name, they're chanting in Tel Aviv, the Egyptian president saying, please come over here and experience this moment. All these countries and all these groups are saying we want to nominate for a Nobel Peace Prize. Do you think that somehow the Democrats might go, okay, listen, he's leaving the country. We'll give you to the 31st of October. Let's open things up for now. I don't know. We'll see. Back to the peace deal, though. Ari Fleischer, former press secretary, Jewish American, cut 12.
Well, what's truly remarkable about this is previous breakthroughs existed between Israel and unique nations, Israel and Egypt, Israel and Jordan. Then you had the Abraham Accords expanding it to a wider group of nations, Bahrain, the UAE. But never before have you had an agreement with Hamas, eight Muslim nations, seven Arab, one nation, Turkey, Muslim nation, Israel, and the United States. That is the breakthrough here.
That is true. You have these other countries that are involved. You know why? I think they're thinking about economic means and economic deals more than they're thinking of terrorism and terrorism deals. Now, I'd look terrible if you played this back in 6 months from now. We see some of the terror activity financed from those countries that Ari Fleischer mentioned. That I don't think Egypt, because they've done so much work to get suppress the Muslim Brotherhood. But if for some reason you have terror financed from Saudi Arabia again, Qatar, UAE, if that starts being the genesis of terror activities, all right, I look terrible. But my sense is they are not thinking like that. They're thinking they got to survive in a rough neighborhood. I get it. But their one problem more than anybody else was Iran. And guess who neutralized Iran? The people that you want to sign it, hopefully, the Abraham Accords with, and that is Israel. They were not upset that Iran's nuclear program was bombed out. Why? Because Saudi Arabia said, as soon as they get nukes, we're getting them. And no one's going to stop us. I'll do a deal with the Russians. I'll do a deal with the Pakistanis. I'll do a deal with North Korea. But we're getting them because we are so concerned about Iran and the balance of power. What they stopped was Israel. You actually saw the end of a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. So there's so much about what the Israelis did for their own security that helped other security. I'm not willing to write this chapter off, but I love the fact we have 24 hours to move to the yellow line in Gaza. That starts the clock for 72 hours to get 48 hostages out, 20 of which are thought to be alive. Mitch Albom, one of America's premier authors with a brand new book called Twice, will be joining us in a moment. Brian Kilmeade Show will have all the breaking news as well. Hi everyone, I'm Brian Kilmeade. It gives me great pleasure to tell you that Simply Safe is now available at 50% off because you're listening to this podcast. So go to simplysafe.com/Brian. Now, why is SimpliSafe so perfect? Number one, it's easily put in. Number two, it's unbelievably effective. Number three, they're using AI now to stop the break-in, not just catch the people that are doing it, but to stop them before they infiltrate your life and destroy your personal property. I personally trust these people. This is a game changer. The agents take action while the intruder is still on the outside. They confront the intruder, letting them know they're being watched on camera, and you know they're going to head for the hills because they're going to head right to prison if they don't, and hopefully they still will. There are no long-term contracts. There are no hidden fees. Get this, the U.S. News and World Report, they named them, SimpliSafe, the best home security system. There's a 60-day money-back guarantee. So what price can you put on safety? Well, SimpliSafe is easy to install. They're always improving the product, and it's affordable. Why can't you be safe? The answer is, of course you can. Go get SimpliSafe. Save your 50% by going to simplisafe.com/Brian. Get it.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we are back, and one of America's premier authors, certainly most successful and thought-provoking, is in studio now. A fantastic radio host, who has also got unbelievable sports knowledge, who I think one of my, every Sunday, watch Sports Reporters with Mitch Albom. He's author of 8 number one New York Times bestsellers. His first big one was Tuesdays with Maury, made it a movie, the best-selling memoir of all time. And Mitch's latest book is called Twice, which is another deep-thinking book, which is certainly to be very successful, who's a great host on everything. So, Mitch, there's nothing you really can't handle. Also, in your spare time, you're also running an orphanage in Haiti.
Yeah, I'm trying to squeeze a few things into my life.
couldn't be a more challenging environment than Haiti.
Yeah,
right?
Haiti's a nightmare right now, and even just to get in, we have to fly to a city that's 150 miles from our orphanage, and then take a helicopter to get down. So the gangs are in terrible control there.
Didn't the congressman help get you out?
Yeah, we had to be airlifted out, and several people from Congress, thank goodness, got us out in the middle of the night. They were shooting at helicopters and everything, and we got airlifted out, and everyone said I'd be crazy to go back, but I was back about a month later.
Because
so.
these kids aren't numbers; they're people to you. These are people that
family.
They're like your family.
Yeah, we have 60 plus kids that we take care of, and we have 18 of them in college here now on scholarships, 2 in medical school. But these kids have nothing; they come to us with nothing, and we have to help them. I mean, I wish America was a little bit more involved, honestly.
Right. I hope we get to that soon because I'm actually doing some studying about the Louisiana Purchase. And we're talking about Haiti.
Is that your next book?
Yeah. Well, kind of. And one of the areas I'm focusing on is Louisiana Purchase. And you didn't realize if the French didn't get so caught up in what we now know as Haiti, I think it was Santo Domingo, and they didn't get so annihilated by people rising up and wanting their freedom, the French might have said, I'm not giving up Louisiana. You're not going to have any deal to get New Orleans. But because they got so hung up and butchered in that conflict, all of a sudden I realized, this is the America would look different. How about that?
Yeah. So Haiti contributed. All right.
Absolutely. So you're also up for a Marconi, I understand?
Yeah. Okay. I have nothing to do with that. And that's crazy. I don't think I deserve that, but we'll see.
Well, you do. Obviously, you got nominated. So tell me the premise of Twice.
So Twice is, I wanted to write a book about people who always keep thinking the grass is always greener on the other side. So I created a story about a guy who discovers when he's a kid that he has the magical ability to do everything in his life a second time if he wants to. But he has to live with the consequences of his second try. He can't go back to the first one or whatever happens the second time, that's it. And he goes through his adolescence fixing his mistakes and his embarrassments with girls and all that kind of stuff. And then when he gets older, he finds out that there's one caveat to the power, and that is it doesn't work with love. So if somebody loves you and you decide you want to go try somebody else, go back in time and see if that other girl or whatever, then that first person can never love you again. That's it. They'll be in the world. You can talk to them, but that's it. And of course, he finds the perfect person, he thinks, and then he gets tempted and he has to make a very fateful decision with his power. So it's all about whether we think the alternative life that we imagine is better than the one we have.
What prompted this? Was it a conversation? Was it something you thought about?
Probably just getting older. And, you know, the older you get, and I'm sure you see this too, Brian, the more the people, your peers start saying, you know, I should have gone a different career. I should have married that girl from whatever. But they don't do it because it's too late in life to go change it. When you're young, if you're in your 20s and you say, I don't like this career, I'm going to go try that one. I don't want this partner, I'm going to try that one. But you reach a certain age is where the concrete starts to settle and you feel like, well, you just can't change anything. And then people start developing these regrets. But my thought process is, well, yeah, you could have taken that career, but that would have brought with it a whole other set of problems. Yeah, you could have married that other person, but you don't know what that would have led to, you know, what comes after. So that whole idea about second chances is kind of floats around me, and I hear it all the time. And I tend to try to write books ever since Tuesdays with Maury that are what people are thinking about, you know, issues that they ask themselves questions. I don't tend to write my books like, oh, I have this great idea for a plot or a character. I think about the themes that people are talking about, and I try to create stories around those.
Because it really sells the story and the belief that people can see themselves in that story.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, I feel like you almost see it as a movie before it's a book, because all your books feel like they're movies. Yeah. Does it first picture the dialogue, and then you knock it down to a book?
No. First you think of the theme, then you think of, I always think of the ending because I want to know where I'm sailing to, and then you kind of create the story. But it's funny you say it about a movie, because for the first time, this book was purchased for a movie before I finished the book. I mean, I don't even know how they got a hold of the early manuscript, but Netflix bought it and got assigned a director and a
writer.
You're
kidding.
It's already, wow. The script is almost done. I said to the screenwriter, you're putting out a script before the book is out. So it was, you know, I guess it's an appealing kind of story.
Wow. Are you thrilled by that?
Yeah. I really like the director and writer. His name is Paul Weitz. He's the guy who did About a Boy and some of the other, it's a really great film. So yeah, I was thrilled by it. But, I mean, usually they wait to see if a book is successful, and then they say, well, let's jump on the bandwagon. This one they did before it even came out.
So the Mitch album that was doing sports, do you feel like you're the same guy, the one who was worried if the Tigers were going to win and what the Yankees were going to – how much they're going to spend on their free agency? Does that seem like the same
guy? Well, I never worried about how much the Yankees were going to spend on their free agency.
But it would be a topic on a Sunday in the morning. Remember the first million-dollar contract people were worried about?
That's kind of, Brian, why this book was kind of natural to me. I've sort of had a twice life, you know. For the first 37 years, that's all I did was sports. And you and I know. We go way back. Yeah. And I was 100 miles an hour, sports reporters. I lived up in Bristol for ESPN for 3 days a week and writing 5 columns a week. And then Tuesdays with Maury happened, and, you know, I wrote a book to pay my old professor's medical expenses. He was dying from Lou Gehrig's disease. You know, we met every Tuesday. It was supposed to be a tiny book. Most publishers told me to get lost. They weren't even interested in it. They printed 20,000 copies for the world, and I thought that would be it, and they'd be in the trunk of my car the rest of my life. And then all of a sudden, it took off, and next thing I know, instead of people asking me who's going to win the Super Bowl, they're coming up and saying, my mother died of cancer, and the last thing we did was read Tuesdays with Maury. Can I talk to you about her? And you have that happen thousands of times, and you become a different person, and your interests become different, and you realize the kind of the grief and the suffering that's going on in the world and what people are into. So while sports kind of always remained a part of my life after that, and I still to this day write a sports column, not frequently, but my interests became much different, and I ended up getting involved in charity and then orphanage in Haiti and a lot of stuff in Detroit. So, no, I mean, I'm not the same person, but I don't think we should be the same person. And that's kind of the point of twice. Everybody thinks, it would be great to have a magic power to go back and undo something, but you already have that power. It's called the next minute of your life. And everything that you learned up to this point enables you to make a different decision in the minute that comes next.
Do you have a personal mission of self-improvement, a conscience, I want to be better?
Totally. I want to be a better person. When I was younger, I wanted to be bigger. That's, I think, the difference between young and mature.
Right.
There's a big difference between old and mature. You know, you can be old and still be young. Yeah. But I think when you're young, you just want to be big, you know, and I wanted my name everywhere. And when you mature, you say, I want to be better.
Right, and that's where you're at now.
That's where I'm at.
And do you think in writing this book, do you learn things about, like, morals and character and things to that nature?
100%.
Because while you're writing, you're literally creating.
Yeah, 100%, because The reason I made love, for example, the caveat, is because I was kind of writing the book to my wife after 37 years that we've been together. I wanted her to know that I understood that love is not a basketball shot that you miss, that you want to go back and just make it and then fix everything. Love is like the first day, the 100th day, the 10,000th day, and everything that happens along the way is what you get. So, yeah, it's true. You could say, well, gee, if I could have married that girl in high school, it'd be like, so. But you're only imagining the first day, right? You're imagining the first date or the first time you sleep with them or the first whatever. You're not imagining 15 years down the pike or 30 years down the pike. But that is what a love relationship is, all the bumps along the road. So I think I even became, hopefully, a better appreciative husband by writing the book.
You also wrote in your last book about you adopted a child.
Yeah.
And then that child passes away, and then you put that story to paper.
Yeah, that was Finding Chica. It was a few books ago. She was one of our kids from Haiti. She had a brain tumor, and we adopted her. They told us she would be dead in 4 months, but we said, well, she's a fighter. You don't know this kid. You know, she survived the earthquake when she was 3 days old. So we traveled around the world with her, and she lived 2 years. And honestly, what's interesting, Brian, is she died. Mm-hmm. And we thought, well, that was our chance of being parents, you know, and at least we got the opportunity. And then 3 years ago, a little girl was brought to us who weighed 6 pounds, and she was 6 months old. And she hadn't had anything to eat in her life but sugar water. She fit in the palm of my hand. Her eyes couldn't open. She couldn't make any sound. And we raced her home, and we put her on this nutrition program to try to feed her around the clock. And we prayed every week. We brought her to the doctor. We put her on the scale. Please gain an ounce, just an ounce, just an ounce. And that little girl is now our little girl.
No way.
Yeah. We have a 3.5-year-old.
Wow.
Yeah. And she's a pistol. Her name is Nadi, and she's the joy of our lives. So we got a second chance, just like this book, twice.
From Haiti?
From Haiti, yeah.
And was she in your orphanage?
Yeah, she was brought to our orphanage, yeah.
Wow. And do we know anything about her background?
Not a lot. No, we don't know a whole lot about a lot of our kids' backgrounds.
Wow, that's incredible. So the people that come to you in Haiti, so you'll just say there's a need there, and will they have to stay there too in the orphanage? Like, they don't come just for school.
If we say, no, they live there. If we say we're taking new kids, there's a line down the block of I have to say no to 10 kids for every one that we can say yes to. Mm-hmm. And yes, they live with us. We take care of them. We get medical treatment. They go to school there, 4 hours in English, 4 hours in French. We have, you know, they're fully fed, 3 meals a day. Everybody gets their own bed. These things in Haiti are not common for children. So it's a big deal, actually, if they can get into our place. But we can't take everybody.
And I can imagine how much more money you'd have for the kids if you didn't have to pay for security.
Yeah, 24 security guards I have now ringing our place because of the gangs in Haiti. I mean, it's crazy. Why should an orphanage have to have 24 security guards?
Have you talked to the State Department about this at all?
I've talked to everybody.
And what do they say?
There's not much interest in Haiti. They don't have much to offer us in return.
You've got to put a government in. I mean, there is no government, right?
Yeah. What I hear a lot is a lot of complaints about what happened after the earthquake and the Clintons and the money that went down there. And I hear that a lot. Like, well, we gave money to Haiti before and it disappeared. And so, you know, it's just a big black hole and so we don't want to fund it. But hey, you know, you're a student of history. We occupied and ran Haiti for 15 years in the early 1900s. We wrote their constitution. Their money was in our bank. We have a history with this country. Mm-hmm. And they're right off our shores. I mean, you know, if they had oil, if the Chinese or Russians mm-hmm. were suddenly interested in it, we'd be down there in a heartbeat. But because that's not happening, we're just allowing people to just, I mean, tens of thousands of people are murdered down there by gangs, and nobody's doing anything about it. People, you can't go out in the street. Our kids haven't left our orphanage in 4 years, haven't gone outside
because
it's not safe to go
outside.
You know,
the other thing is this thing called the United Nations, a few blocks from here. I mean, if you talk about a humanitarian effort, that would be it. And I think they have money for security.
And all they do is just keep meeting and making suggestions and all that. The problem actually began when the United Nations left in 2017. They had been there after the earthquake. And they ostensibly were there to help rebuild the country. But when you see UN trucks going around and they have guns and whatever, the gangs don't act up. As soon as they left, there was a void. The gangs started rising. And now they run Port-au-Prince. And in many ways, they basically over overthrow the country.
And they overthrew, didn't the...
Somebody killed the president.
Did the first lady kill the president?
Well, I have no idea. I mean, I'm like... Nobody's figured it out yet who killed him. But once he was gone, the power vacuum created this opportunity for these gangs. And they own 90% of Port-au-Prince. Can you imagine if 90% of New York, where we are right now, was under gang control? Mm-hmm. Our orphanage is in the 10%, thank God, that isn't under gang control yet. But we have bullets landing in our yard all the time.
So the UN would have to come in guns a-blazing. They'd have to come in looking to...
I don't know about guns a-blazing. Most of these gang members, more than half of them, are under 17 years old. They're mostly just kids with guns. But because nobody else has guns in Haiti, the people who have the guns are running things. I think if you just sent down a peacekeeping force and went in there and they started trying to take back these neighborhoods that have been taken over by these gangs, they would quell it and a lot of these gangs would run. They'd disappear. I don't think it requires an army, but it does require some kind of effort. And right now, nobody's making that.
How much of your time is taken up with this?
I go every month.
Every month?
Yeah, for about a week.
And that's incredible. And you're able to balance things out and still write a sports column?
Well, I don't write very many sports columns, but once in a while, yeah, when I'm home in the other 3 weeks and the people around me are very forgiving and allow me to, you know, do this work and do the other work.
Lastly, are you worried about baseball?
As the sport or about the Tigers?
No, about as a sport.
Well, yeah, I mean, I do think it, I think it's losing young people, you know. I think football has just taken up all the oxygen in the room. I do think they made a good move with the pitch count thing and the clock to speed up the games because they were on a death spiral before that.
Especially if you're covering them.
ESPN 5 hours. And now it's funny. You go to the playoffs and we're back to 3.5 hour long games. It's like, what happened? You know, during the season, they were over in 2 hours and 10 minutes. But, you know, it's the nature of the game. I mean, I don't know how much you can do. You can't make it look like the NBA. But, you know, I think there'll always be a market for it, but it's not going to be the nation's pastime.
Right. And Mitch, you're not upset that the Yankees lost yesterday, for the record?
No, I'm not. I live in Detroit. We're still alive.
I know. Absolutely. And doing it on a budget. Mitch Albom's got a brand new novel out. It's already going to be a movie. Netflix has bought it and wrote the script. It's called Twice. You got to pick it up, and I know you will. Mitch, congratulations on all this.
Brian, it's great to see you, man. Thank you.
Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Every day, America's first responders stand ready. Firefighters, law enforcement, paramedics, doctors, dispatchers, and people who put themselves on the line for public safety. But keeping them connected in moments of crisis has not been easy. That's why Congress authorized a nationwide network for public safety. Today, that promise is fulfilled through FirstNet. It's the only nationwide network built with and for first responders. So whether it's a big city, rural town, or remote tribal community, FirstNet helps ensure no call for help goes unanswered. It gives first responders priority access, never throttles their communications in the U.S., helping them to connect across agencies when it matters most. This isn't just a network. It's a lifeline, a bipartisan commitment to America's public safety, built to serve those who serve us all. FirstNet is the backbone of our nation's emergency response and will continue to be in the future. FirstNet, built with AT&T. Learn more on firstnet.com/public safety first.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
So we got a couple of minutes here, and I want you to hear this Katie Porter. She's up by about 7 points in the gubernatorial race, and there's really no big name involved. Villagrosa, the former mayor of Los Angeles, didn't really do a great job. I think his name is in there. And Steve Hilton is a solid third, but he's a Republican, heavily MAGA. I'm not sure if MAGA can win in California with 40% of the vote. That's about it as Republican, especially there's a lot of Republicans who are moderate that don't, and there's not many, but that don't like Trump. But listen to Katie Porter. This is how despicable this woman is. Also, she's got blow-ups before. She does not have a great reputation or a hard worker. She's sitting down with CBS, and she sits down, and here's a little of her exchange.
So you don't?
I feel like this is unnecessarily argumentative. What is your question?
Do you think you need any of those 40% of California voters to win? And you're saying, no, you don't.
No, I'm saying I'm going to try to win every vote I can. And what I'm saying to you is that
Well, to those voters. Okay, so you...
I don't want to keep doing this. I'm going to call it. Okay. Thank you.
You're not going to do the interview with us?
Nope, not like this. I'm not. Not with 7 follow-ups to every single question you ask.
Every other candidate has answered our follow-ups.
I don't care. I want to have a pleasant, positive conversation in which you ask me about every issue on this list. And if every question, you're going to make up a follow-up question, then we're never going to get there.
Ms. Porter, we're
just going to circle around.
Out of all the objections that I've heard, I've never heard you keep asking follow-up questions ever be a complaint. Some people say hard interview, soft interview, or that's out of bounds. It's too personal and people get upset. I understand that. Or you told me. But just because you're asking tough, hard questions, she's got to drop out.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
All right, from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, around the country, around the world, we are all paying attention to what's happening in the Middle East. More on that in a moment. Quick announcement about the Patriot Awards. Go to foxnation.com/Patriot Awards. Big event coming up on Long Island University, my former college. My college that I went to, it'll be November 6th. So hope to see everyone out there. I had a look at the rundown. It'll be the biggest show ever. Bottom line is you don't want to miss it. It's really going to be more red, white, and blue than ever. This hour, we're going to be joined by Josh Krasher, Fox News Radio political analyst, editor-in-chief of the Jewish Insider. Man, does he come in handy today, a perfect booking. And Congressman Mike Lawler brawling it out verbally. In the House yesterday, in the Capitol building. He's also on the Foreign Affairs Committee. We're going to touch on those main stories in the big three.
Number three.
So you don't
I
think
feel like this is unnecessarily argumentative. What is your question?
Well, to those voters. Okay, so you...
I don't want to keep doing this. I'm going to call it. Okay. Thank you.
You're not going to do the interview with us?
Nope, not like this. I'm not. Not with 7 follow-ups to every single question you ask.
It's the worst. Follow-up questions. Democratic politics of incompetence, from California governor frontrunner to the New Jersey governor race. We see Dems in the lead, but their flaws are jaw-dropping. America deserves better. Is it time for people to forget about their party?
Number two.
How will you decide which workers get back pay and which workers do not?
Well, we're going to see. Most of them are going to get back pay, and we're going to try and make sure of that, but some of them are being hurt very badly by the Democrats, and they therefore won't qualify.
On the here we go. Shutdown on day 9, and tensions are exploding on both sides. Will anything break the deadlock?
Number one.
The 20-point plan developed by Steve Witkoff with Jared Kushner is one of the most elegant pieces of diplomacy we can remember in recent years.
Yes, Ambassador Michael Oren, on the precipice of peace. President Trump is preparing to fly to Egypt to sign a deal to bring the fighting to an end in Gaza and begin the rebuilding process. It's only phase one, but it's already begun. Congressman Mike Lawler, we understand the IDF is beginning to move back to the yellow line within Gaza within 24 hours, and then the 72-hour time clock will start to release the hostages. Your thoughts about this plan?
Well, this is a remarkable achievement. Obviously, we want to see it come to fruition. But President Trump deserves all the credit in the world for this. This was due to his efforts, his vision, and his team really working with our Arab partners, with our greatest ally, Israel, to get this done. And the president made clear when he came into office that he was going to get the hostages home. And he is on the verge of getting that done. This is really just a momentous moment in the Middle East. The fact is that President Trump has been the greatest force for good in the Middle East and establishing peace and stability. Mm. You look back with the Abraham Accords, now Steve Witkoff, Jared Kushner helping lead these negotiations to get this done. This is going to be a remarkable moment over the next 72 to 96 hours.
So what do the Palestinians get? 1,950 prisoners back within those 72 hours. They'll be put on buses. Obviously, the logistics matter, out of which, 250 roughly have death sentences, which means they've killed before. And the big debate on Marwan Barghouti, I guess he is the person that is probably the highest profile prisoner. But so far, the Israelis have said we're not letting him out. There's blood on his hands.
No question. And, you know, obviously this is a very difficult negotiation. It's why it required so many of our Arab partners to be involved. And, you know, long term, we're going to have to make sure that there is accountability here. There cannot be backsliding. Obviously, the threat against Israel remains, and we need to ensure the safety and stability within the region and ensure that Israel does not face these continued threats from terrorism, which is why Hamas can never remain in power, why the Palestinian Authority long-term cannot be in power. And so, you know, we are at the beginning of what is going to be a very long process, but I think this is a tremendous step forward. And, you know, look, Brian, the reality is we can either make progress or we can continue down this path. And I don't think anybody wants this to continue.
Yeah, I want to talk about the shutdown and how it's related, but I want you to hear Dave Ignatius, who knows a lot about that region. He said the first phase is tough, but the next phase is tougher. Cut nine.
The next phase is going to be difficult because Hamas essentially has to agree to surrender, has to agree to give up its weapons. Hamas fighters who give their weapons will get amnesty, allowing a kind of calm to return to Gaza. But the final terms, where Israel will withdraw to, exactly who will run Gaza, whether Hamas can be held to President Trump's demand that they play no role whatsoever in the future governance of Gaza is still remains to be seen.
So that's just it, the next phase. They have to decommission their weapons while giving up their rockets.
No question about it. And that obviously is going to be the more difficult endeavor here. But, you know, this is why I've always said the fastest way for this to end was for the hostages to be released and Hamas to surrender. And that's essentially what this deal will do. But it is complex. And that's why having our Arab partners at the table is vital. You can't get this done if there is not full cooperation within the Middle East. President Trump, by going to Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the UAE earlier this year, the engagement with numerous leaders across the Middle East, including Erdogan in Turkey, you know, this is vital if we're going to get this done. And, you know, I think you're seeing not only diplomacy in action, but you're seeing a real effort towards peace and prosperity in the Middle East, which, you know, if we look back historically, it's never happened like this before. So this is obviously a momentous moment, but it also obviously is fraught with concern. You know, the old adage, trust but verify. And I think that's where it is going to be critical to hold people to account.
See if there are such things as Palestinian technocrats, because they're supposed to do the rebuilding. So I want to bring you to a confrontation you had yesterday intentionally with the minority leader, Hakeem Jeffries. Let's listen to some of it. Cut 35.
Why don't we sign on right now?
Did your boss, Donald Trump?
You can
Trump?
Easily extend the ACA right now.
Did your
right
boss,
now.
Donald Trump?
He's
give
not
you
my boss.
Yes, he is.
No, he's not. And by the way,
so let me ask you a
why
question.
Did you vote to
let
shut the government
question.
Down? No, it's sad.
Relevant.
It's sad. You could easily sign on to
you're
this.
You're embarrassing yourself
right now.
You could
right
sign
now. On to this. The only you're embarrassment here is
you. You're not going to talk to me and talk
and
over me.
New York residents
because you don't want to hear what I have to say.
Oh, I'm listening.
So why don't you just keep your mouth shut?
So what happened?
Hakeem Jeffries had a complete and utter meltdown. He was yelling, stuttering, stammering. He couldn't answer one single question. And I went there to make the point that, look, if you want the health care subsidies that were put in place during COVID extended, I'm on a bill along with 14 Republicans and 11 Democrats to extend this by a year. Why won't you sign on to this bill if you're so serious about doing this? And this isn't for show. Sign on to a clean one-year extension. And he just wouldn't do it. And obviously, you know, look, Democrats have shut the government down for one reason and one reason only. They're petrified of AOC, Zohran Mamdani, and the radical left. You look at, you know, I asked him in that conversation, when are you going to endorse Zohran? Why are you so scared? What is it that you're waiting on? Why won't you condemn his blame the Jews statement on October 7th? And he had no answers. He just refused to even acknowledge anything because they're just petrified. And it's really, it's embarrassing for somebody who professes to be the Democratic leader. I mean, good grief. He doesn't even hold Nancy Pelosi's purse, given the way he comported himself yesterday.
And by the way, she's a shell of herself. Whatever she was, she's not that anymore. She can't even get a line out. Here's more. Cut 36.
I voted for a clean CR to keep the government open and funded. You voted to shut it
you're
down.
You're embarrassing yourself right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, leader, with all due respect, you're the one.
Why are you playing yourself?
You're the one who actually voted to shut the government down.
Actually, you know that's not true.
It's sad. You voted to shut the government down.
Do Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the President?
Right, and you're smart enough to know that you need 60 votes in the Senate, right?
Is that right? No.
Do you need 60 votes in the Senate or no?
Were 60 votes needed to pass your one big ugly bill?
Reconciliation, which you did with the IRA. Boy, that really reduced inflation.
Are you trying to elevate yourself because you're afraid you're about to lose re-election?
I'm not trying to elevate myself. No, I'm not going to lose re-election. You spent $42 million last cycle. You didn't do that great.
I've indulged you. I've given you your 15
minutes
of fame.
You haven't answered any of the questions.
You're a complete and total embarrassment.
Yeah.
You're embarrassing yourself and your district right now, and you're going down to defeat next year.
Well, I'm pretty sure he's wrong about the defeat, and you're probably going to have an easier time this time. But have you ever had a confrontation like that with him before?
Actually, on the House floor a few weeks ago, I went up to him about his hypocrisy on redistricting, because New York did mid-decade redistricting last year at his behest. And he's out there screaming and yelling about, gerrymandering. But meanwhile, New York did it twice. And so I called him out on it, and he had a meltdown on the floor. Telling me, oh, you know more than I do. You know more than I do. You think you know more than I do. Who are you? Who are you? You know, he's very arrogant, condescending, thinks who he is. I mean, I'm sorry, bro. We're all elected by 780,000 people. You're no more important than any other member. You're one of 435, and your vote counts just as much as mine.
True. But you didn't stop there. My Speaker Johnson seemed to be confronted by his senator from Arizona, and you joined in.
All due respect, you voted multiple times to keep the government shut down, okay? The Republican members from Arizona voted to keep the government open. So don't sit here and try to lecture us about whether or not we did our job. We did our job. You did not.
Well, you're not doing your job right now.
Oh, you mean the bill that I'm signed on to extend it?
Oh, yeah.
Cute, right. Because you know what? We actually have put forth legislation to do it.
So we set the scene there. What was going on yesterday?
Well, I had just finished a interview, and I was outside the speaker's office, and Ruben Gallego and Mark Kelly came up to do a little gaggle outside the speaker's office. And so I was standing on the side, and then the speaker came out and started answering their questions and rebutting their talking points. And, you know, ultimately they were trying to accost them. So I jumped in, as any New Yorker would, and called them out on their nonsense. The fact is, House Republicans passed a clean CR nearly 3 weeks ago to keep the government funded and open, to pay our troops, to pay our border patrol, to ensure that Americans reliant on WIC or SNAP have the funding and resources that they need. Chuck Schumer and Senate Democrats are standing in the way. Ruben Gallego and Mark Kelly voted no multiple times to keep the government open. So when they're bashing their Arizona Republican colleagues, the fact is Arizona Republicans in the House voted to keep the government open. And I pointed that out. And then they're talking about, you know, Epstein and trying to make it all about that and talking about protecting pedophiles. The fact is, the Trump administration is the one that prosecuted Jeffrey Epstein, number one. Number two, House Republicans on the Oversight Committee have released over 30,000 documents. They're in the middle of going through the records of the Epstein estate. That is a result of our work and our approval. This whole argument about the discharge petition is absurd on its face. The fact is, Joe Biden was in charge for 4 years. Democrats said absolutely nothing about Jeffrey Epstein.
Yep.
They said absolutely nothing about the people that were involved in his crimes. I have said,
what do you think Ro Khanna cares about Jeffrey Epstein? Why does he suddenly care? What about Tom Massie? Where were they for 10 years?
Well, Ro Khanna is angling to run for president. So this is all about elevating himself. He said nothing for 4 years. And I called him out on that in an interview. And he just said, well, you know, it wasn't an issue until Donald Trump made it an issue. This is all they know. All they know is Donald Trump. They're a joke. And it really is embarrassing for our country. They're not serious about addressing the problems facing this country.
So Chuck Schumer just has come out and say every day gets better for us, for Democrats, the longer the shutdown lasts. Does that really make, how does that make people feel who are missing paychecks, military, who are not getting paychecks, air traffic controllers? And Schumer says it gets better for us every day. What's wrong with him?
Think about that. Look, this is what happens when you've been in office for 50 years. You've never held a job outside of government. You're entirely reliant on taxpayer-funded paychecks. You are completely oblivious to the impact of these decisions on the American people. And the fact is, Chuck Schumer just doesn't care. Chuck Schumer is petrified of a primary from AOC. And that is why he is doing this. That is why he shut the government down. He wants to show the radical left that he's fighting back against Trump. He's now doing videos on Capitol Hill cursing. You know what? I've said it before and I'll say it again. Chuck Schumer is the biggest schmuck in Washington. And it's time for him to go after 50 years in elected office. 50 years. Go home.
Right. Listen, I'm not going to push back on that, even though I'd be a better host if I did. I think it's absolutely done. It would be great for somebody to have the guts to at least stand up to your socialist mayoral candidate who's a radical leftist. But instead, he does nothing, which means he does something. That means you're kind of endorsing. Lastly, Mike, do you think by any chance, with the president leaving the country and knowing that usually presidents come in and will orchestrate the end of a shutdown, there's no chance of that happening. He's going to be leaving the country in the next couple of days. What does that do for the shutdown? Do you think that both sides might go, this is historic, maybe we go back to work for 3 weeks?
Well, think about that. Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries have shut the government down, and President Trump is negotiating Middle East peace. All right, that's the dichotomy here. That's the difference. They're playing politics. President Trump's trying to solve an international crisis that resulted in the deaths of Americans. Americans were killed on October 7th, and these guys are playing tiddly dinks in Washington, D.C. The bottom line is it's time to open up the government. Chuck Schumer should do so today. Get on the Senate floor, vote yes, open up the government, and let's get back to work.
He's in a battleground district, and he's always doing battle. Congressman Mike Lawler with the fireworks. Thanks so much, Congressman. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate
it. You got it. He's with the 17th. Back in a moment.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Without the use of force, this 20 points would not have been possible. And the use of force not just against Hamas, but also against Iran. The President Trump was willing to step up and project American power. What's missing, I think, from the conversation this morning is the restoration, the revival of the Pax Americana after years of withdrawal and isolationism in the Middle East. And that, I think, is truly maybe the most historic consequence of these 20 points of this agreement. Now, having said all that, you know, this is maybe the end of the beginning. Hamas still has its guns. Hamas is still embedded in Gaza. Houthis are still firing. Iran is now rebuilding. The war may be far from over, but the fact is that these hostages are returning, and that was Israel's major war aim. It is an extraordinary achievement.
It is. And Ambassador Warren was in on almost all these talks. So that's why it's important, too. He understands our culture. He's an Israeli ambassador to the U.S. And obviously, he's Israeli. So he really is. Well, when you hear him talk, he's an insider. He could choose not to tell you everything, but he knows everything. He's not an observer or analyst. When we come back, we'll squeeze in some calls this hour. But Josh Krasher will be next. He writes for the Jewish Insider. He's also going to bring us inside politics. And the horrible interview that just surfaced about Katie Porter leading the charge to be the next governor of California. Don't we all have to have standards above party? Don't you think?
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I think most of us are very optimistic. We believe we're on the right path. If something goes sideways, it's going to be a surprise to everyone, because this right now looks like a done deal. And I've been looking forward to taking this yellow ribbon off my lapel since I arrived. And I hope that sometime between now and Tuesday, this is coming off and I'll never see it again. It will be a sign that all the hostages are home with their families.
Remember, Ambassador Huckabee went over there, and this has been a crisis in motion. And, you know, Iran bombing happened in the interim. You saw the Houthi rebels are constantly a threat, and Hamas war and the uproar and the demonstrations. You know, Netanyahu, there was a lot of demonstrations against the prime minister because they thought that he was dragging it out for his own political fortunes. I think that's one of the worst things you could say about anybody, to think that hostages could be living in a living hell because somebody wants to stay as prime minister. They already had the job for 20 years. I thought that was one of the worst conclusions that you could make about an individual. I think he's just looking for total victory. Is he stopping short of that? Does he have a choice? Is this really his choice? I think it is. Josh Krasher joins us now. Fox News Radio political analyst, editor-in-chief of the Jewish Insider. Josh, is this a deal you think the prime minister is happy with?
Well, look, I think everyone in Israel is happy that all of the hostages are going to be released. That includes all the living hostages and as you know, presumably all of the remains of the dead hostages. That's one part of the overall Trump 20-point peace plan. I think the bigger question for the prime minister and for Israelis after that release takes place is, will Hamas be pushed out of Gaza? Will there actually be able to be a transition to a non-extremist, non-terroristic governing structure, which I think is a lot harder. A lot of the details in the Trump peace plan are very detailed. It goes into a lot of technocratic areas in which governance can improve and where we can get to a better place at the end of the tunnel. But it is, that's the harder part. But I think, you know, look, a lot of the military successes that Israel has had from that Prime Minister Netanyahu has led, whether it was taking out Iran's nuclear programs, whether it was degrading Hezbollah to the north, whether it was, you know, even going into Gaza City and being tough with Qatar and targeting the Hamas leaders there, I think that degree of military pressure also brought Hamas, but also some of the Arab countries to the table. They want the war to end, and they're willing to do it on terms that I think are generally quite favorable to Israel.
I do, too. I absolutely do. I think they're favorable to Israel. They don't say, we demand a two-state solution. We demand total elimination of the West Bank. We demand 1967 borders. Guess who said that? Mahmoud Abbas, the irrelevant Palestinian Authority leader who's overstayed his term for 30 years? So the question is there a such thing, Josh, and I'm not being sarcastic, I actually want this answer. Is there a such thing as a Palestinian technocrat that's going to help with the logistics of rebuilding roads and houses and worry about a collection of taxes and trying to build some semblance of a society?
So historically, the sad reality has been through all the previous peace talks and negotiations, Oslo most notably, is that there's been a promise of that kind of governance, but that never has been the reality. And that does, Hamas is obviously the most extreme Islamic extreme, you know, Muslim Brotherhood aligned extremist group, but the Palestinian Authority also was perpetuating, you know, in the past, terrorist attack after the Oslo peace process, and that hope has never been realized. So I think, you know, we talked about trust but verify. In the context of dealing with a hostage situation with Hamas, you know, there's going to be a lot of verification necessary as we go after this first phase and try to figure out a pathway to figure out some governing structure. Now, the fact that the U.S. is involved, Tony Blair very much involved, the fact that I think the moderate Arab countries, the allies of Israel, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, even Qatar, I think, put some pressure on Hamas at the end to maybe get this deal done effectively. That's going to be, I think, the key here. There's a lot of pressure that the Arab countries can put, and there's a lot of momentum, whether it's de-radicalizing their own populations or working to de-radicalize the Palestinian population, accepting normalization of Israel. These are things that are kind of basic things, recognizing another country that exists, not teaching your kids in schools to kill and murder and commit terrorism, basic fundamental building blocks. Then we probably in the long term can talk about the prospect of healthy governance. But it's going to take a while. And I think there's a lot of hope, but there's also a lot of skepticism that, you know, we're not even sure right now, Brian, whether, you know, Hamas is still going to be in charge. I mean, the hope is that won't be the case, but Hamas is probably going to try to stall after the hostages are released and trying to keep some form of power in Gaza. And that's no formula for peace and no formula for any kind of.
So you're saying, suppose they say, well, we only have 10 hostages left. Sorry. Or five bodies instead of 46. So if they come out with the number that we don't agree with, this whole thing could start getting derailed because we have so little faith. Evidently, the people around Witkoff have said they've had a deal done, and Hamas at the last minute changes their terms. And that's why people are getting totally fed up, and they said the process will never yield a result. But I think it was something on the hit in Doha that changed things. And then the phone call reportedly from the prime minister with President Trump there saying that we regret the loss of that guy and the security guy and that we didn't get the targets and maybe we shouldn't take in a shot, won't do it again. And they say, where do we go from here? Let's get this deal done. And now Turkey somehow came in. Something about Turkey's visit to the White House changed their stance on Israel. And I believe it has to do with the F-35s, don't you think?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, one of the reasons why Trump was uniquely positioned to get this deal done is that he does have good personal relationships with Turkey and Erdogan and also the Qatari leader. I mean, there's been a lot of close relationships, for better or for worse, with the Qataris. And the Qataris have been playing both sides of the street. They've harbored Hamas political officials while also hosting the peace negotiations. But I think Trump has unique leverage, and I think he used that leverage, certainly with Qatar. Turkey is another obviously big player that wants a good relationship with the United States, wants military supplies as part of NATO. So there's a lot of cards that Trump played, I think, very effectively. Look, I think he also, I mean, we talked, Netanyahu needed some cover too, because he does have a very, he's to the, some of his coalition partners are to the right that didn't want it, and they may still vote against this deal. So that, but Trump is more, is the most popular figure in Israel. Trump is seen as a hero. He's going to be visiting, by the way, Israel this weekend, speaking to Knesset, the parliament there. You couldn't get more popular anywhere in any context than Trump will be this weekend in Israel. And the fact that Trump did have the capital to tell Bibi, even if you don't like every single thing in the deal, let's take the deal, let's move forward, let's negotiate. That was a key. I mean, Trump really played all his cards very, very effectively.
He did, and he brought them all together at the right time. And here's the thing. I always knew that sometimes you have a president that loves Israel, George W. Bush, an example, and Donald Trump. And they have others that are always skeptical. Joe Biden, always all over the place. Barack Obama did not like Netanyahu, was not a fan of Israel. He wasn't even standing up for him in the UN by the time he was done. George H.W. Bush, they say, wasn't as big a supporter as, let's say, Ronald Reagan. I get it. But Trump is the best friend Israel ever had at the time at which they were needed most. But at the same time, he went to Saudi Arabia. You saw him in the UAE. You saw him in Qatar. You saw the way the Bahrain, and we've always had good relations there, of course, with the base and everything else. So you see those relationships. And when the president didn't go and visit Israel, they thought, well, no, that's not a good move. You should tell everyone, end your trip with Israel. And he said, no, I'm not. I'm going to just, I have a separate relationship with these guys. That's separate from Israel, and they're ineffective. And a lot of Middle East experts said, oh, that's a mistake. People read that as, you like the Arab world better, and it's going to leave Israel isolated, and they're going to act more, however, fill in the blank. But what he did is played it perfect in that he's not criticizing the government setup of any of these Middle Eastern countries. He's saying, how do I do trade with you, and how do we solve this problem? Because no one says Hamas is right, but that is something that they felt as they have to deal with. The Palestinians aren't really welcomed in any capital.
Yeah. So Trump understands power. And even when I remember talking to Middle East diplomats and leaders before Trump even took office the first time, and they there were a lot of, again, allied countries to the U.S. that were just sort of in awe of Trump because he knows how to wield power. We see this domestically. We see this on the international stage. He really has a lot of muscle, and he has the relationships too. Like you said, his business relationships, personal relationships with a lot of these Arab leaders as well. But that he speaks the language of the Middle East very, very well. And Trump understands just pure power politics. And that, I think, is a unique insight that Trump has in this region, especially, that has allowed him to have more success than any other, or at least certainly Biden and Obama before him. I mean, Biden, I think Obama was much more hostile to Israel than even Biden. Biden, I think, was trying to kind of do the same thing in terms of being, giving Israel be supportive in some ways, but then trying to withhold aid in other ways. But the problem was Biden was so weak. No one, listened to Joe Biden. He didn't have, from his age to his political capital and political muscle, he had no strength at all. And Trump, he was not respected in a lot of those same capitals.
Josh, I don't have to remind our listeners, when he went to visit Netanyahu after the October 7th attacks, he wanted to visit Islamic capital, Muslim capitals, Arab capitals. He wanted to go to Qatar. He wanted to go to Egypt. They said no. They said don't come.
Yeah, I mean, part of the success is also Trump having the relationship with Qatar. But we don't know what happened behind the scenes. But I'm sure, especially after the attack in Doha, that Trump both was very receptive to put an executive order out saying the U.S. will defend Qatar. But I'm sure there was a lot of behind the scenes pressure that you can't have your TV networks promoting Hamas and terrorism. You can't. You need to put pressure on Hamas. This isn't going to happen again. You need to kick Hamas out and really put pressure on them accepting a deal. I'm sure we'll find out in the coming days and weeks, a lot of that pressure that Trump utilized as part of those relationships. So he speaks the language. He obviously utilized power politics in the region very effectively. And he's getting plugged. I mean, I actually am surprised. I'm a little surprised. Democrats and people who are not fans of Trump are actually having to acknowledge how successful he's been with this peacemaking process. And maybe he will get the peace next year, at least, in the Nobel Peace Prize as a result of these efforts.
I mean, when I see the people that have won it in the past, and I'm not saying it's not a great thing, but I just don't understand the glory of it. It's not like winning the Stanley Cup. You win, you know, 4-7 game series. I just think it is what it is. I don't think if I'm Trump, I don't need that trophy in order to say what I have accomplished or not accomplished. But the president has goals, and that's one that he wants to get. The other thing to keep in mind, too, is that the president's going to go over there and he's going to be in Egypt and he's going to be in Israel. You know where he's not going to be? In Washington. And you know, presidents usually find a way to land the plane with these shutdowns. How is that going to affect the shutdown negotiations?
Yeah, that's a worry that this White House needs to pay attention to. Something. So there are presidents that have great international achievements, and then they need to figure out the domestic politics as well. And there are some. I mean, look, I think if you look at the polling, both the Republicans and Democrats are getting blamed from the public. But it also hasn't. Compared to other government shutdowns, this has not been front and center as I think other previous shutdowns have been, and I think this could go on for quite some time. But there is some pressure. You hear Marjorie. I mean, I don't think Marjorie Taylor Greene is representative at all of the Republican Party. But I always say the party that's united is the side that's winning. The one that starts to have defections and people speaking out has to face a little more pressure. And you know, I think there is some pressure on the Republican side and for Trump. I think it is something that if these delays and shutdowns and the flight delays and people being inconvenienced as a result of the shutdown, that I wouldn't want to be the party in power that has to deal with this if it goes on past 2 weeks, and we're already well past the 1 week part, 1 week mark.
Chuck Schumer came out and said, "The longer it goes, the better it is for us." Is that the stupidest statement you ever heard in your life? Even if you think
it's sort of amazing. I mean, how he's handled the shutdown politics. He was against the shutdown the first time. He's for the shutdown this time. He's playing to his base. I mean, he is worried. I mean, the Democratic Party has gotten, in the last few months especially, gotten far to the left, trying to pander to the activists within their party that are demanding hardball politics when it comes to the shutdown. So I don't think that plays. I mean, the Democrats have their fingerprints over this one. They're getting some of the blame. And I don't think Schumer is handling. I mean, especially for those swing state lawmakers, it's not great to be in power, in charge, and also presiding over a government shutdown and not seeming like you're doing your job.
So last night when you were watching the Yankees and the Phillies and seeing the latest on the peace deal, you missed the New Jersey governor gubernatorial debate, the last one they'll have. And here's what Jack Cittarelli can win or lose on, and that's energy, because he knows exactly why energy costs are too high, and it's actually factually correct. Cut 45.
My opponent has put forth an illegitimate plan that isn't feasible. Even the governor, a member of her own party, has said that, "I don't really think you can do that." There are 77 incumbent Democratic legislators, 52 of which are on the ballot this year, and not one has endorsed her plan. To get electricity rates down on day one, I will pull us out of RGGI. The Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative is a carbon tax policy that has cost New Jersey $300 to $500 million a year for homeowners, tenants, and businesses. And it's been a failure. Electricity is at its all-time high. The air is no cleaner, and ratepayer dollars are going to other states. So we can provide some relief on day one.
Pennsylvania does their fracking. They use their pipelines. New York and New Jersey doesn't. And now New Jersey, which was energy independent, is now paying you ridiculously high prices when it comes to energy. And that's what that's this type of stuff he's running on. Your thoughts about where this race is, because the polls say Cheryl is up 6 or 7.
This is a close race, closer than, I mean, Democrats thought they had this in the bag a few weeks ago, but the polling that they've done and people I've talked to suggest that this is margin of error territory. And it's the reason why is what you just hit on, Brian. It's the fact that Democrats have been running on this affordability, the economy, affordability issues. In New Jersey, the Democrats have been in power, and they're the ones taking the heat for the cost of energy, the cost of groceries, the cost of living. And it's really a big problem, and especially if you live in a lot of the suburban areas of New Jersey where prices have gone through the roof. Cheryl represents a very affluent district in northern New Jersey. She didn't do all that well in the Democratic primary, especially from working class Democrats. And I think what we're seeing is like a weakness, that the sort of an out of touchness that we saw in the New Jersey, in the presidential race in New Jersey. Trump only lost New Jersey by I think 6 points. And certainly Cittarelli came within a few points 4 years ago of beating Governor Murphy. There are a lot of working class voters that are feeling disconnected. I mean, Democrats want to run on affordability. Well, the Democrats are in charge of affordability in New Jersey over the last 8 years, and it hasn't gone well. So I think that is the secret sauce that Cittarelli has really used to stay in that race.
All right, Josh, thanks for unveiling the secret right here. Josh Krashauer, Historic Times. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
All right, back in a moment. I see your calls up there. We'll get to them.
Don't go anywhere. Brian Kilmeade will be right back. It's Will Kane Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern Monday through Thursday at foxnews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Yeah, we've got a couple of minutes left. So, I mean, it's a pretty exciting times when you see what's going on overseas. Because I'm looking at the New York Times today. You know, they cover the breaking news. It's no longer you get the paper and then you wait for the next day. They're always rolling in the new news. The second story, I thought I had the wrong page open. I thought it was the Wall Street Journal. With this deal, Trump is on the brink of a major diplomatic accomplishment. I'm not saying that's glorious headlines, but for the New York Times to admit on the second story, and the above story is just the details of the deal, and I read it expecting to see the solar, the rabbit punch in the back of the head that kind of is the left-handed compliment, and it wasn't. They said there's a lot of questions, but they use word like hope, and it's possible, as opposed to, a fever dream, or the history says it's not going to happen. And I also know the Washington Post is doing, I'm not saying the New York Times changed, but I know the Washington Post, they make an intentional move to go to the middle. They're letting all their columnists who are showing outrage show them the door, and they're weaving in conservative columnists to join Mark Thiessen. I would rather see just nonpartisan reporters. The columnists are the columnists. I always like diversity of opinion. I just like to see the stories accurate.
Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. Brian Kilmeade Show coming your direction. So much going on. You don't need to go anywhere else. We got the news as well as analysis. This hour, we're going to be joined by Jack Cittarelli, standing by, the Republican gubernatorial candidate for New Jersey. Everybody's watching this race and the Virginia races, especially in New Jersey, which is subtly turning a little bit more red and being maybe in play because of bad political decisions and a terrible ideologically driven governor in Governor Murphy. Trey Gowdy at the bottom of the hour. And, of course, we'll take your calls. Before we get to Mr. Cittarelli, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
So you don't
think... I feel like this is unnecessarily argumentative. What is your question?
Well, to those voters. Okay, so you...
I don't want to keep doing this. I'm going to call it. Okay. Thank you.
You're not going to do the interview with us?
Nope, not like this. I'm not. Not with 7 follow-ups to every single question you ask.
Katie Porter, the worst. That was CBS, who finally published their whole interview. They learned their lesson from 60 Minutes. Democratic political politics of incompetence. From California to the front runner there to the New Jersey governor's race here. We see Democrats in the lead, but their flaws are jaw-dropping. Will Americans stop voting for their party and start voting for the best person?
Number two.
How will you decide which workers get back pay and which workers do not?
Well, we're going to see. Most of them are going to get back pay, and we're going to try and make sure of that. But some of them are being hurt very badly by the Democrats, and they therefore won't qualify.
There it is. The President of the United States talking about shutdown day nine. What an embarrassment. Tensions are exploding on both sides. We'll bring in the play-by-play.
Number one.
The 20-point plan developed by Steve Witkoff with Jared Kushner is one of the most elegant pieces of diplomacy we can remember in recent years.
Yep, and it's yielded results. On the precipice of peace, President Trump is preparing to fly to Egypt to sign a deal to bring the fighting to an end in Gaza. We understand the IDF is backing out of Gaza to a yellow line that's already been agreed upon, and that'll have 24 hours to do it, and then 72-hour time clock starts to release all the hostages who have been tortured over the last few years. Joining us now is Jack Cittarelli, running for governor of New Jersey and storming from behind very strongly. Jack, first off, your reaction. I know you're focused on your debate, and I don't blame you and all the issues of New Jersey. That's got to be. But it's hard not to notice something historic happening like what's happening in the Middle East, isn't it?
This is historic, and we tip our cap to the president for taking a leadership role here. Peace is long overdue, but most importantly, the release of the hostages.
Absolutely, and hopefully they're going to be back soon. Your debate last night, how do you think it went?
I thought it went very, very well. And showing, pointing out the differences between the two candidates. Once again, we got generalities, platitudes, and lies from my opponent, and we called her out on it each and every time. But I thought you saw a real act of desperation when she lied about my private sector career and accusing me of having killed personally 10,000 people. Talk about a desperate tactic by a desperate candidate.
In what respect? I must have missed that.
She was making mention of the fact that as a medical publisher, I was a partner of some of the leading academic medical centers in the country, and we did continuing medical education programs for doctors. And she's claiming because some of those dealt with pain management as a topic that I was the reason for the opioid epidemic across New Jersey. And that in so doing, I personally responsible for the loss of 10,000 lives.
Here is Mikey Sherrill talking about you and putting down people who work in public service. Cut 43.
You know, my opponent denigrates public service at every turn. He said law enforcement shouldn't get the pay they get because there's a lot more dangerous jobs out there where people make less. He's voted against our pension system in the past. Again and again, he puts down people who serve the public. I'm proud of my service at the U.S. Attorney's Office. I'm proud of my service in the U.S. military. And I'm proud of people who serve. And as governor, I'm going to make sure I have their backs.
Your follow-up was?
No, I pointed out the fact that this is somebody who's endorsed Mondami, and Mondami's endorsed her, and you couldn't have a more anti-police potential mayor of New York City than Mondami. This is somebody who voted to get rid of qualified immunity for local police, which is the bedrock of the protection that enables them to do the job that they do, and also that I'm the only one endorsed by police unions across the state because she's not pro-police and because she's talked about reappointing our current attorney general, who's been the most anti-police attorney general in our state's history.
Has she ever answered the question of why she was kicked out of college, why she was not allowed to walk after graduation?
She's given us an explanation, but I will tell you it's a lie. What she has said is the reason why she was punished at the Naval Academy, not being allowed to walk in the graduation, not having her name listed in the commencement exercise program, is because she refused to turn in classmates who were cheating. That's not true. And so we believe she either cheated herself or she lied to the investigators. All she has to do is approve the release of her disciplinary records to come clean and be transparent with the people of New Jersey as to why she was punished at the Naval Academy. You know, Brian, she's built her entire political career upon this Naval Academy experience and serving in the military. We salute her military service, as I do my Army captain's son, but she needs to come clean with the state of New Jersey as to why she was severely punished at the Naval Academy.
So you're saying you don't know. You don't know if she's telling the truth or not because the records aren't out there. You don't know if it's worse or than the cheating scandal, right? You just know that
Correct.
She wasn't allowed to walk and she was involved somehow. She will not release the details.
Right. And if what she is saying is true, then why would you hesitate in releasing your disciplinary records? The disciplinary records would then confirm what it is that she's saying, that she wouldn't turn in her classmates. The honor code at West Point says this: you shall not cheat, you shall not lie, and you will not tolerate those who do. That's not the honor code at the Naval Academy. You don't necessarily get punished for not turning in a classmate. All it says is you will not lie. And so we believe that she's not telling the truth as to why she was severely punished.
So here she is talking about the number one issue for people of New Jersey, and that is energy costs, utility costs. Cut 44.
I constantly hear about this from voters. So that's why on day one, I'm declaring a state of emergency on energy prices, freezing rate hikes. I'm going to take on the PBMs. Those are those middlemen that can drive up drug prices up to 10 times, driving down your health care costs. And I'm going to ensure that I'm taking on those landlords that are colluding to drive up your rental prices. So housing, health care, utility costs, immediately get to work driving down your costs. And quite frankly, we know my opponent won't do it because his number one donor is somebody who's actually under investigation for driving up those rental costs. So I'm going to continue to fight for New Jerseyans, and my opponent just won't.
Do those sound like solid programs?
They are not. In fact, her energy plan, there are 77 incumbent Democratic legislators in New Jersey, 52 of which are on the ballot this year. Not one has embraced her illegitimate and not feasible energy plan to lower electricity costs. Even the governor, a member of her own party, was on TV and said, I don't think you can do that. Listen, it's one lie after another. He doesn't understand New Jersey. The way to get our electric rates down is to pull out a RGGI. The Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative is a carbon tax policy that has failed New Jerseyans. I could save $300 million to $500 million a year for homeowners, tenants, and businesses by pulling out a RGGI. And all of her other proposals are really, really razor thin, lack specifics. And it's all about generalities and platitudes out of the Congresswoman.
So this morning we had a voter panel that watched your debate, and your debate was up against the Phillies game for Southern New Jersey, big Phillies fans there, and the Yankee game. So it's not easy. So a lot of people are going to be watching the clips back. We had a voter panel that watched the debate. They came in, and here's what they said.
After watching the debate, did it change any of your minds? If it did change your mind watching the debate, raise your hand. So it had no impact. All right.
So, you know, they had some nice things to say. Some thought that Mikey Sherrill was better. But did you need to score a knockout? Do you think you had a knockout last night and we just picked three panelists that didn't reflect that? Or do you feel as though there's enough time to close the gap further?
Brian, there are four polls that have this as a dead heat, if not me, with a 1-point lead. There are a couple polls that have me down by 5 to 7 points. Those are the same polls that had Kamala Harris winning New Jersey last year by 20-plus. She only won by 6. Those are the same polls that had me down by 12 points with 2 weeks to go last time. We lost by only 3 points. The fact that I have the endorsements of prominent Democratic elected officials around the state says that all the energy is on our side. The momentum is on our side. I'm telling you, in comparing this to 21, when I thought we were going to win, this time I know we're going to win. The energy across the state has been electric.
But, Jack, the one thing you say, for example, I don't care what you think of Trump. Trump's not going to win in California, and he's not going to win in New Jersey. So Trump says he's got my full endorsement. And that you were asked, you know, where are you different? And you're different when it comes to windmills, right?
Different from my opponent or different from Trump?
Trump.
Listen, I'm very grateful for the fact he's put a temporary halt on wind farms off the Jersey Shore. I'm concerned that he's approved the wind farm off of the Empire wind farm off of Long Island. And so we hope that doesn't lead to him changing his mind on the temporary halt off the Jersey Shore. We do not want those wind farms. We think it ruins the ecology of our ocean, which is critically important to recreational and commercial fishing, which is a very significant component of our state economy. Not to mention, it's just not a good source of energy. It's not reliable, and it's very, very expensive. There are other ways that produce energy here in the state of New Jersey. And so But he has been very good to New Jersey in other ways. He's beaten up on the New York Democrats over congestion pricing, but most of all, the big, beautiful bill. I mean, this thing raises the property tax deduction on your federal tax return to $40,000. That's critically important to New Jerseyans who pay the highest property taxes in the nation. It doubles the child care tax credit for families with young children. It doesn't tax tips, overtime, and Social Security. And it provides a magnificent tax credit for those who send their kids to private school. And my opponent voted no. All those things add up to anywhere to a $4,000 to $5,000 savings for the average middle-class family.
Going into the election without Trump's endorsement last time, where do the polls have you?
Well, the polls at the end, our polls had it as a dead heat. The polls that showed a difference were the ones that came out of our universities, which usually don't do a very good job of investing the necessary money to get the right kind of sample size. Brian, I'm telling you, we're right where we need to be with regard to the polls. And let's not forget one thing. Trump lost New Jersey in 2020 by 16 points. I lost 12 months later by 3. I outperformed Glenn Youngkin in Virginia that year. Okay. 4 years later, Trump loses New Jersey by 6 points. He improved by over 10 points. That was the single largest improvement of the 50 states. Now, no, he didn't win New Jersey. But guess what? 10 points is the equivalent of about 300,000 people that feel differently about Donald Trump today than they did back in 2020.
And right now, how many Democratic mayors have endorsed you?
We've gotten the endorsement of 4 different Democratic mayors, a couple of former mayors, and also county commissioners across the state. And I will tell you, there's a whole lot of others that have just told me very privately, Jack, we're with you. We need a change. They realize she's just a continuation of Phil Murphy's failed policies, Murphy 2.0.
And Murphy, she said that you would give Murphy a B and how he's done over these 8 years. What about you?
Oh, my goodness, Brian. It's an F. It's been a failure across the board. The affordability crisis because of property taxes and monthly electricity bills is all on him. The public safety crisis, the spike in nonviolent crime because we've handcuffed our police. We're going to let them do their job. The public education crisis because they watered down the public school curriculum. We've slipped from 2 to 12 on the national report card. The overdevelopment crisis in our suburban communities because of all this social engineering with this high-density housing taking Garden right out of the Garden State. It's been failure after failure after failure. His signature issue, cannabis, even the rollout of that has been a total failure. Ask the minority communities all across the state that he told them it was all about social justice. I mean, the whole thing's just been an enormous failure.
And people of New Jersey deserve better. I don't think Mikey Sherrill's is one of the, I think she's one of the weakest candidates that I have seen. And they thought she was just going to roll to a victory. And as some, I read in Axios a couple of days ago, a Democratic strategist says, basically her message is, isn't Trump really bad? And haven't they learned that that's not going to fly anymore? And soon it's not going to not even make any sense.
Yep. I mean, her whole campaign is based on a stack of lies about me, disdain for Donald Trump, and she can fly a helicopter. Is that what's going to fix New Jersey?
Not yet.
Come on.
I don't think so.
She's not even from New Jersey.
And you have generations that have had businesses there, right?
We have. The Cheddarellis have been here for 100 years. 3 generations of us have all been business owners, job creators, and have all achieved our American dream right here in New Jersey. And unlike my opponent, I don't need the job. Unlike my opponent, I don't want to be senator. I don't want to be vice president. I don't want to be president. I just want to fix the state I love.
All right. Jack Chitterell against Mikey Sherrill in the backstretch after their final debate last night. Jack, best of luck.
Brian, thank you.
Absolutely. 1-866-408-7669. We're going to take your calls next. Our first stop will be Israel, where all the action's happening and the celebrations have begun.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
We're going to lose more than 500,000 Californians dying prematurely to air pollution and other problems. And the state could lose out of my shot.
I wanted to tell you that that's actually incorrect. It's not that it's electric vehicles. It's that if we don't meet the commitments under the Paris Climate Accord.
Okay. It does. Okay. You also were in my shot before that. Stay out of my shot. Okay. I'm going to start again with electric vehicles saving us money.
What a nightmare. Katie Porter wants to be the next governor. She's a failed congresswoman. She's whining, they see, in 2021 about Joe Biden won't see her. And even though she raised so much money for him, she doesn't have any access to the White House, complaining that she has follow-up questions with the CBS local reporter. Unbelievable that she does that, and that's the way she treats her staff, which is interesting. She was asked about this, and her explanation, I mean, she can't run from it, but she says, she says, I'm looking to treat my staff better, and I learn from it in the future. You said, some of my colleagues have, okay, I got it. It's no secret I hold myself and my staff to a high standard. And that was especially true as a member of Congress. Porter told Politico in a statement, quote, I have sought to be more intentional in showing gratitude to my staff for their important work. What does that even mean? Is that an apology? I want to be more intentional in showing gratitude. Get the blank out of my shot.
Eric had a great point, Brian, when you listen to that cut. Clearly a staff member, she was not fazed by it at all when she screamed at her. She's like, okay, well, by the way, I'm just trying to correct you. I wasn't like, oh my goodness, you just screamed at me, like profanities.
And you know what the staffer's doing? Saying what you're saying is wrong.
Yeah.
So you have it wrong. So instead of saying, why are you here? We'll get that wrong. Okay, let me start again from the top. So now, that's the way you guys are when I yell at you, right? You don't blink.
We're so used to it, Brian.
Right, you're so used to
it. We're so beaten down.
Right.
We don't know what else.
Eric is a shell of who he was. Because of my temper. And it's not that my problem is not that I drink at work, is I drink after work and I bring the hangover to the show.
I mean, that's why we try to keep you hydrated and have
right.
Tylenol.
And no in-studio guests. They don't want to smell alcohol.
And we keep your soccer ball deflated so it's not as hard.
Right. That's absolutely true. So this is one of the quotes from the other thing from Katie Porter that resolved. Video of an exchange exclusively obtained by Politico Wednesday shows an online conversation between Porter and then Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm. Several minutes in, Porter's staffer interjected to correct something the Democrat representative had said about the electric vehicles when she jumped in. She also complained and vented, I don't fit in the photo op, I guess, for some reason at the White House. I'm not invited there. And then her colleague came back and said, I think you're wrong. You're always invited. Evidently, she was there four or five times.
Such a nasty one.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Why don't we sign on right now?
Did your boss, Donald Trump?
You can
Trump?
Easily extend the ACA right now.
Did your
right
boss,
now?
Donald Trump,
he's
give
not
you
my
permission?
Boss.
Yes, he is.
No, he's not. And by the way,
so let me ask you a
why
question.
Did you vote to shut the government down?
No,
it's sad. It's sad. You could easily sign on to
you're
this.
You're embarrassing yourself
you could
right
sign
now.
On to this. The only
you're
embarrassment here is
Trump.
You.
You're not going to talk to me and talk
and
over me.
New York residents
because you don't want to hear what I have to say.
Oh, I'm listening.
So why don't you just keep your mouth shut?
Well, that's what he has to say, keep your mouth shut. Trey Gowdy joins us now. Trey, how much do you miss being in Congress after hearing that lovely exchange in the halls?
I did not miss it even before Lawler and Hakeem got into that little scrum. I'd rather work with Brian Kilmeade than anybody that's currently in the House.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty amazing what's going on, but I think the tempers are boiling over. I mean, that went on, and there was another cut on that. And then there was another time in which Speaker Johnson was confronted by the senator from Arizona. And then Mike Lawler came in again. Let's listen.
All due respect, you voted multiple times to keep the government shut down, okay? The Republican members from Arizona voted to keep the government open. So don't sit here and try to lecture us about whether or not we did our job. We did our job. You did not.
Well, you're not doing your job right now.
Oh, so you mean the bill that I'm signed on to extend it?
Oh, yeah.
Cute, right, because you know what? We actually have put forth legislation to do it.
And it is. This is a continuing resolution to fund on the Biden funding levels. They want to add the health care into it because they care about people. So that was another time in which kind of the speaker was ambushed. So what does this tell you about decorum in Washington?
Yeah, I mean, so I don't think anybody wins a shutdown fight, but you can sure lose one. And I was actually talking to a senator this morning, a Republican senator. They're going to keep teeing up votes. It's hard to fight through the dominant media headwind. Republicans usually don't fare well in shutdowns, but there are three reasons that we are currently in this shutdown right now, Brian. Three reasons. AOC. Those are the three reasons. Schumer knows that he is going to be primaried by AOC, so he sends out these cringy videos. I mean, people his age should not be using social media. Literally.
I know.
I called the FCC and filed a complaint. It was so cringeworthy. That's why we're shut down. I had Mike on Sunday night, and I've talked to Mike since then. Literally, this is a continuation of the status quo. What was good enough 2 weeks ago is now not good enough for them. You're in the minority, guys. What do you think we're going to give you? What did you give up? Like, I'll prove that I'm fair. I knew that President Obama was never going to sign the repeal of something called Obamacare. I knew that was never going to happen.
Guess what, guys? We are not going to treat you like you won the last election when you did not.
And they're trying to unwind some of the big, beautiful bill, and they're trying to get it back to pre-pandemic levels. Now they let people in. They were 400% over the poverty level, making six figures get Medicaid. That's not what it was meant for.
Nope. But Republicans have always struggled, not through their fault. I mean, look, you've been in D.C. The headwind walking around the halls of Congress, which is why I tell my friends, you got to get out. You got to get out and go back home. Politico, The Hill, all those D.C. rags. I mean, it is rare for Republicans to get a fair deal in a shutdown. But under these facts, when we are offering you a continuation of the status quo, Schumer is going to be primaried to the left, and he knows that, and that's why we're doing this.
So he came out yesterday or today, and he said, the longer this goes on, the more we're winning, the better we do. Really? Is he that dumb? There's yes. People that aren't getting paychecks in the military, you know, the people that aren't getting paychecks, air traffic controllers who doesn't seem to want to go to work anymore. Now he says the better we do, the longer it goes on.
Go back and look at those old clips of what he had to say about shutdowns in the past. Like, there's never a good reason to not pay soldiers, law enforcement, even your staff. Look, senators, for the most part, members of the House, not all, but most of them are people of wealth. Staff are not. And you got to keep working. So, look, I don't know that you can win a shutdown, but you can sure lose one. Republicans have been pretty good in their messaging, but they got to keep it up because the media kind of bias is to blame Republicans for a shutdown. The more Thune makes them vote, the more they vote no. I think they picked up, what, three Democrats last time they voted. My Senate friends tell me they're just going to – here's the silver lining if there is one, and I don't think there is one, but they are moving tons and tons of confirmations because they got nothing else to do.
Yeah, that's true. They got a whole bunch of people through, including getting Herschel Walker to the Caribbean as an ambassador. So he gets to get out there and have some fun. That used to be a cushy job, but now that actually could be busy because of Venezuela and how the drug trafficking is going through the Caribbean. So it looks like Mike Waltz is in place from a few weeks ago. So that's going to be a huge asset. So, Trey, do you believe the president leaving town to sign this peace deal and the magnitude of what he's doing? He's not going on an economic trip. It's not a G20. It is a historic peace deal. And we think he's going Tuesday. So without a president in the middle of this out of the country, what happens to the shutdown?
Well, I think number one, you know this as well as I do. Donald Trump is never inaccessible. I was texting with him at 11:30 last night. He is never inaccessible. And I do think that what is happening in the Middle East is historic, and I don't think it would have happened without him. And also give credit to Marco and Witkoff and Jared Kushner and others. If there's – I mean, first of all, I think the Republican position is we're not negotiating with the minority party. Y'all lost. We're not undoing what we just passed. We're not adding $1 trillion for healthcare subsidies for people that are not indigent. We're not doing that. So why would he need to be around? I will say this, he's always open to a deal, and he's a phone call away. He is more accessible, Brian, honestly, than some of my childhood friends. They're harder to get on the phone than Donald Trump.
I know. He was texting with Jake Tapper, too, and people saying, how could he do that? Well, Jake Tapper has to understand at one point you could be a critic every day, but what other president, after the way he's been treated by and the way he soft-pedaled President Biden, would be texting you back to make your show better? Nobody. But they don't seem to appreciate that.
I think he's wired. People that don't know him don't know this and don't believe it. He is wired to be generous. Now, when you hit him, he's going to hit you back harder than you hit him. But his default is to be a generous, gracious person. That is his default.
I know. That's the person I know as well. I think they're going to realize when he's out of office that your description's accurate. They're just not capable of doing it now. So Marjorie Taylor Greene is one of the first defectors. Now she's doing CNN, talking about the need to get health care costs under control, that her family's premiums are going up. But a bigger story is in November, when everyone gets their new premiums for the year, most of them will be going up. And Democrats want to make sure everyone knows it's Republicans' fault. And what they're going to say is, whatever the health care costs are, the health care costs have everything to do with what they should be at because they were pre-pandemic levels, yet we were still subsidizing as if the pandemic was still happening. And also, does this underline what you fought against, and that is Obamacare? Isn't that proving to be an epic fail?
Yeah, I mean, I the whole Obamacare, keep your doctor, nothing's going to change. We do need to reform our health care delivery system, whether it's litigation cost, whether it's the freedom. I mean, look, we've been fighting this battle for gosh, 20-something years now. I mean, on the one hand, I'm really, really proud of our healthcare system. I don't want the one that Canada has. I don't want the ones that the Nordic countries have. But the cost is, I mean, most folks get it from their employer. So, but if you're making over $100,000, we got to look at why the premiums are going up. And that kind of feeds into the overall health narrative. What drives up the cost? I mean, we're living longer, obesity, so what we eat, smoking, all the things we enjoy in terms of freedom. But that's a broader conversation. The conversation right now is about whether the federal government should subsidize health care. And I think the conservative response to that is it is a state matter. That would be the conservative response, a la Medicaid.
I hear you. And I think, obviously we need a mature conversation, not a political conversation, when it comes to health care and what the cost could be down and a restructuring has to take place. But throwing money at it when it takes 2/3 of our budget already, along with Social Security, is not the way to do it. No matter what you do on non-discretionary spending, we're never going to be close to balancing a budget that now we're, I guess, over $1 trillion each year over budget. We're never going to get there unless we can get rid of
it. I'm so glad you said that, Brian, because I just don't think people can get their heads around this. If we zeroed out discretionary spending, literally spent nothing, we would still run a deficit for this year because of what we call mandatory spending, interest on the debt, Medicare, Social Security. So there are systemic, look, when Social Security went into existence, the life expectancy for an African-American man was that you would be dead before you drew your first benefit. Thank the Lord we are now living longer. I mean, I think women, their life expectancy is in the late 80s. So you're talking about, I just bumped into a friend of mine who owns his own business. Today's his birthday, and he said, thank God next year I get Medicare. Well, look, I mean, he's paid into it. He's entitled to it. But I'm not indigent. Maybe I ought to be paying more for my Medicare. So we got to have a mature conversation, but you can't do it because then you start pushing the Speaker of the House off a cliff, or him pushing a senior citizen off a cliff in a wheelchair, and that's what passes for debate. And the last Republican that tried to take on mandatory entitlements was Paul Ryan, and they ran ads of him literally pushing a grandmother off a cliff, and Barack Obama sat there and perpetuated the myth. So no one wants to have the conversation that you just raised, which is we're going to always be mired in debt until we deal with mandatory spending.
I hear you, and that's going to take some, people got to, if we could find a way to pay down the debt, we pay less interest, and that could go a lot to doing other things that we want to do. But Trey, let me bring you first to, before I let you go, and then promo your show, James Comey. The strength of the case, I understand it, you could disabuse me of this thought, that we really don't know the case against James Comey, that only the grand jury does and the prosecutors do. We do not know everything they have against him. Am I under the right assumption?
No, you are. Once again, you are correct, and I'll prove it to folks. So I've talked to Todd Blanche, and Pam alluded to this, AG Bondi, when she was before the Senate. So what we know is the video exchange between Cruz and Comey, and we know that Andy McCabe would make a terrible witness. Those are two things that we know. No decent prosecutor is going to go to court with only that. So I had Todd Lynch on the show about a week ago, and he, you know, look, he can't comment on an ongoing case, which handcuffs him, but he did allude to the fact that the FBI, if you think that's all they have, then you're crazy. Now, is it enough? Look, it is hard to convince 12 people beyond a reasonable doubt of anything this day and age. It is hard. Being a prosecutor is hard. Getting all 12, 11 out of 12 doesn't do it. All 12. Having said that, they have more than the video and more than Andy McCabe, who will not make a good witness, or else they would not have gone forward. That does not mean that you're going to get a conviction. But the standard for charging someone is not beyond a reasonable doubt. It's probable cause. And clearly they have it because a grand jury returned two counts on him. I don't know what's going to happen in trial. He's got a good lawyer. I'm sure there'll be good prosecutors. It'll be up to 12 people in the Eastern District of Virginia. But the notion that he shouldn't be charged, or the guy who was on stage in a book tour admitting that he treated Donald Trump differently from the way he would have treated Barack Obama, is now worried about selective prosecution? Are you kidding me?
I know. And he said that at the 92nd Y, and he got a big laugh out of saying that.
Yes.
And
yes.
He does. I mean, you're very proud of what he's doing, and he's just saying this does not seem normal. Think about how many lives have been ruined. Michael Flynn, Paul Manafort, Peter Navarro. A lot of these people's lives have been ruined because they would look to turn on Trump.
Papadopoulos.
Oh, sure.
Page.
Yeah.
How about Hope Hicks? Hope Hicks drug in there, having to spend an afternoon with Adam Schiff, itself is a violation of the Eighth Amendment. But for the way he treated her and Trump family members, I was in the room for all of it. So I was talking to Devin last night, who I give a ton
Nunes,
of credit.
Yeah.
Devin is the one who saw this a decade ago. It's been a decade, Brian. It has been a decade. And people forget. Now the left loves Jim Comey. People forget this is the same Jim Comey that gave Hillary Clinton the questions before he interviewed her and decided he wasn't going to charge her before he interviewed her. And now you're worried about selective prosecution. No one engaged in it more than you did, Comey.
Yeah, but he'll never admit to that. He'd feel bad for you for bringing it up.
Because he's right and we're all wrong, and he wrote a book about morality and all that. Now, he's Icarus. He literally is the Greek figure Icarus. He thinks that he's flying really close to the sun. Whether or not a jury will convict him, history will. I can tell you that.
So, Trey, who's on? Have you figured out who's on Sunday? You're going to wait.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed to say Lindsey Graham's coming on. I'm really working on John Thune. So we're going to talk about crime. We got a good lineup. The problem is I am the opening act for a guy named Brian Kilmeade. Yeah. So Kilmeade is you two, and I'm a garage band nobody's heard of.
That
but
is
we
not
do
true.
Have good guests.
That humble act, we gotta get rid of that. Your ratings are through the roof. It's a much watched show. Hey Trey, thanks so much. 9 o'clock Eastern time. Make sure you check him out on Sunday.
Yeah, and contribute around for 10 o'clock for One Nation with Brian Kilmeade.
Right, and when we come back, I'll tell you exactly who's going to be on that show. Don't move.
Learning something new every day on the Brian Kilmeade Show. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
But also, why not unblock all your conservative loved ones and admit that they're not Hitler, even those with an undescended testicle?
What? No, so not right. I'd storm off. Katie Porter didn't beat me to it.
I'll be finished in a little bit, young man.
Thank you very much.
Kilmeade, you've overcome a lot of physical defects. And it is, I think, homely people have it harder than short people. So what's your, I mean, you must feel a bit punctured by her words.
You know what hurts me most?
What?
He sat around all day to write that insulting question. Because you are actually reading the insult. So this is not coming from the inside. This is coming from your team of writers.
No, I wrote this handwriting, yeah. Physical defects. I was going to put deformities, but I thought that was too harsh.
Right, thank you. I appreciate you walking it back. And it's the last time I open up in the green room about my testicle issue. You bring it up on the show. I thought I could open up to you.
To Brian's point and his undescended testicle, it is so inauthentic the next day to be like, I mean, the wrecking ball is right here. You know, we need to just stop
the
with carving.
Ball?
Well, you know, you just got the one.
I just
know. I'm trying to turn your deformity into a positive here.
So how did that even get out of control? I guess this is what he said. He said that Hitler had only one testicle.
And therefore...
And that's why he...
Went to you and then the rest of the show through making
so
fun. It's not every day I can say, I pulled the testicle montage, Eric. You can grab it.
Did you say that?
I did.
I figure. And he knew exactly what you're talking about?
Yep.
Hey, don't forget One Nation, by the way. It's Thursday. We got a great roster of guests from Hewitt on down. We also have some other great guests, too. We got Emily Austin's going to be there. Don't give it all away.